From NPR News, this is News in No Time, Tony Cox. The world's global crisis continues to deepen as high unemployment rates hit Spain, Ireland, France, and the United States. Just last week, European leaders met in Berlin to devise a plan to kickstart the economy on the other side of the Atlantic, while here at home, President Barack Obama signed a $787 billion stimulus package. But how did we get here, and which nations are hurting and which are not? Joining me now to explain more is Nariman Baravesh. He is Chief Economist and Executive Vice President of IHS Global Insight, a forecasting company that provides analysis on the world's economic and financial markets. Nariman, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This financial crisis that began here in this country was triggered largely by issues tied to the housing and credit markets, but its impact is certainly not limited to our borders. Briefly tell us about the main factors that have led to this global meltdown.
Well, as you say, the meltdown is global, and the sources were global. Certainly, the U.S. played a big role in it. No debate about that, and the housing bubble and the related subprime crisis that came with it were a big factor, but it wasn't the only factor. In fact, if you look at credit growth everywhere in the world, Europe, Asia, China in particular, even parts of the Middle East, that credit growth and that credit bubble were huge, arguably the biggest in history. But again, the emphasis is on global. Everybody participated in this binge, if you want to call it that, in terms of very rapid growth in credit. And it showed up, again, not just in housing in the U.S., but house prices in the U.K. shot up, Ireland, Spain. You saw stock markets in many emerging markets shoot up. And last but not least, we saw commodity prices shoot up. So these were all bubbles that were inflated by this global sort of credit binge, if you want to put it that way.
Well, it appears that the fallout from the recession is being felt hardest at the moment in both Europe and parts of Asia, specifically Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, all major trading partners with the U.S. My question is, are these problems fueled by lower exports as opposed to a subprime mortgage crisis?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that some of the problems, especially Asia, it's more a question of the fact that world trade has collapsed. In part, that's been triggered by, you know, deep recessions in the U.S., now deep recessions in Europe. So you know, a lot of Asian countries that export to Europe and to the U.S. just are seeing their export orders just plummet, and it's hurting them. So they are getting hurt by this. In other parts of the emerging world, in Eastern Europe, let's say, in particular, there it's much more this credit crunch, where these are countries that have borrowed a lot in dollars, in euros, in Swiss francs, and they're getting clobbered by now high interest rates and this tightening up of credit that's occurring worldwide.
Now, the economies in Africa, let's say, and the Caribbean are different, are they not, from either the U.S., Europe, or Asia? And I'm thinking, for example, of the $1 million notes being printed up willy-nilly in Zimbabwe. How has the global downturn affected them?
Well, just on Zimbabwe for a minute. Zimbabwe has a whole host of problems that are really quite unrelated to the credit crunch and the financial crisis. These have been problems that have been in the making for a long, long time because of an economy that's been run into the ground. But more generally, Africa and Latin America are being hurt, but it doesn't seem quite as bad, for example, as those in Eastern Europe. Their debt levels are not as high. While they're hurting some because of the big fall in commodity prices, I mean, we've seen, for example, the first negative growth in South Africa since 1998. But I don't think these are as hard hit because the financial exposure in this part of the world is not as great as, let's say, it is in the U.S., certainly in Europe and parts of emerging Europe.
Is that what is allowing some countries to be, I hesitate to use the word financially successful at the moment, but allowing them to compete in a way that they had not been able to before?
Well, it's possible, I think. I think everybody's getting hurt. The only question is how much. And as we were saying earlier, many of the countries in Africa and Latin America seem to be, for the moment at least, being hurt less than countries in other regions like, say, Russia or Ukraine or Hungary. So it's a matter of relative hurt rather than success.
Ah, that's a good way of putting it. Now, when trouble strikes, immigrants and their families may choose to head home, or they could be forced to return if their visas depend on having a job. What impact has the economic downturn had on immigration?
It's been quite large. Immigration is one measure of globalization, Others are, of course, investment flows and trade, and they've all fallen. But immigrants in particular often get hurt first, if you will, partly because the jobs dry up, so they voluntarily leave, as you were saying, but partly because some of them are guest workers that are sent home because the host country, if you will, has no jobs for them and views them in a way possibly as a threat to local workers. So they often, immigrants, that is to say, often will get hit first before the local workers do.
But the final thing is this. We've hit all the continents except for Australia, and I don't know what their circumstance is economically. Is it as I would assume that perhaps it is like it is in Western Europe. Am I correct?
I think you're right. There are some differences between Australia and Western Europe. You're right in the sense that it is a mature economy, but it's also a country that exports a lot of commodities. So Australia, for example, has been hit pretty hard by the huge drop. It's an 80% drop in commodity prices, you know, all kinds of things, coal, metals, and so on. So Australia, as well, as being hurt, not because it had its own sort of inherent financial problems, but this is a global recession.
Nariman, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Nariman Bharavesh. He is chief economist and executive vice president of IHS Global Insight, a forecasting company that provides analysis on the world's economic and financial markets. He joined us from Boston Bureau Productions in Boston, Massachusetts. So one of the regions that seems to be doing better than most, for now at least, is Latin America. But why is that? Joining me now is Augusto de la Torre. He is the World Bank's chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean. Welcome, sir.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Fine. Thank you very much. Let's talk about the situation in Latin America. And it doesn't appear to be as severe there as it is in some other parts of the world. Which countries in the region are suffering least?
Latin America used to be the region of crisis, where crisis used to be the most frequent and most sinister. And this time around, Latin America is being hit from an outside shock, and the shock finds Latin America in a relatively strong position in terms of its domestic policy frameworks. So the shock this time is very interesting for Latin America, contrast with its past, where domestic financial system and domestic policies are not a source of trouble, independent source of trouble. Therefore, as the shock is coming from outside, it's hitting Latin American countries that are most open and small and have greatest exposure to the U.S. markets.
Now, we're saying
Central America and Mexico. South America, by contrast, is being hit with a delay. When you go to Colombia or Peru, people are aware of the bad news of the global economy, but in their local economies, they do not feel the impact with great strength yet.
Now we're seeing reports, for example, that say that unemployment has hit every sector in Latin America. Even the bodyguards in drug-torn countries like Colombia are losing their jobs. How big an issue is unemployment?
It will become an increasingly more important issue as time goes by. Latin America, in contrast, say with Asia, is less integrated into the production chain. So the fall in exports over Latin America are essentially the fall of commodity exports, and they are not very intense in employment. However, as the tsunami of global problems propagates through Latin America, unemployment will start picking up in other sectors, eventually including in the non-tradable sectors of like services and so forth. So in countries like Mexico, surely the impact is already being felt, given its proximity to the U.S. In other countries, it's coming with some delay. But unemployment and recession are the name of the situation for Latin America, not financial meltdown.
Now, you know, in this country, the housing crisis, particularly fed by the subprime mortgage crisis, led to the recession to a large degree. Back in 2007, you did a presentation about Latin America and the Caribbean building what you called an immune system against that kind of housing mortgage-related crisis. What did that involve?
Well, following the several crises that Latin America had in the 1990s, bank regulators and supervisors were particularly cautious. So Latin America built perhaps a stronger than in the past, certainly, and comparatively to other regions, a stronger frameworks of bank regulation and supervision. The systems in Latin America became more conservative. And as a result, they did not get into these new fashionable instruments, sophisticated instruments that became popular in the U.S. in the developed markets. As a result of being perhaps significantly behind these innovations, the Latin American financial systems now find themselves with better quality loans, more resilient banking systems, better capitalized. It doesn't mean that this crisis will not affect domestic markets. It will affect, but the domestic markets are in a better position to absorb the what's coming to them.
Our final question is this, and I have only about 10 seconds for you to answer. Are you confident that things will improve in Latin America, perhaps more quickly than in the United States or elsewhere?
Once the torment and once this storm passes, Latin America should be in a position to rebound faster than other regions.
I appreciate your coming on. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
That was Augusto de la Torre. He is the World Bank's chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. This week, Archbishop Desmond Tutu urges President Obama to apologize for the Iraq War, plus deadly violence against peacekeepers in Somalia, and the father of modern African literature returns home to Nigeria. For more, we've got Roxanne Lawson. She's Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Let's begin with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who recently wrote an article for the BBC News website urging President Barack Obama to apologize for the invasion of Iraq. The Nobel Peace Prize winner said Mr. Obama should not risk squandering the goodwill his election has generated. He also says he prays that Mr. Obama will be tough on African dictators and asked him to speak out against tyranny in Africa. So what's been the reaction to the Archbishop's comments?
The reaction has obviously, I think, been positive. I think the only criticism is that for Trans-Africa Forum, for some of our partners, we wish that he'd asked the United States government to apologize to the people of both Ethiopia and Somalia for supporting the Ethiopian invasion and occupation of Somalia, which has had a disastrous impact on Somalis across the region of the Horn of Africa.
What's the significance of this request, though, for President Obama coming from Tutu?
I think that Desmond Tutu, obviously being a wonderful, internationally known humanitarian, peacemaker, statesman, this kind of request shows the great mantle that President Obama actually has to take up, that people across the globe are looking to him to help the U.S. right itself, to move from an environment of the last 7 to 8 years of militarization and bilateral responses to a new place of multilateral engagement, of being not just a leader, but a real partner with people across the globe and helping them to solve solutions to their own problems.
One last thing on this. It would seem as if this has ratcheted up sort of the foreign policy give and take, because if the president, Obama, I mean, does not come forward with an apology, that sets up a chain of other events potentially.
This is true. I mean, but the president is in a really difficult situation. I mean, there's lots of things the U.S. government needs to apologize for. They could apologize for slavery. They could apologize for aiding and abetting many dictators across the globe over the last 30 years. This latest, like, kind of spot on the U.S. and our ability to say that we are the leaders around humanitarian efforts and global good governance is one that needs to be addressed. But to apologize for Iraq when we're still with many troops on the ground, when we have there's no solution in sight to the problems that ail that country, I think would be maybe a nice gesture, but what really I think the president needs to be doing is finding a real Iraq policy that gets U.S. troops out of Iraq, that lets the Iraqi country go back to Iraqis and have them govern themselves.
All right, Roxanne, let's move on to another topic, on to the Horn of Africa, where last week more than 300 clerics and clan elders gathered in the capital city, Mogadishu, to demand African Union peacekeepers leave Somalia within 120 days. Just days later, Somali Islamist insurgents killed 11 AU peacekeepers from Burundi in an attack on an AU military base. And today, continued fighting has left at least 15 people dead, 60 others wounded. And against this backdrop, you have Burundian and Ugandan AU peacekeepers said to be the only foreign troops still in the city, although there is some conflicting information about whether or not the Ethiopian troops are still there as well. My question to you is, who is in control?
Well, I think right now it's hard to say. I think it's easiest to say who's not in control, and that's the Somali people. And they're the people who are mobilizing their clerics, mobilizing different factions, both armed and unarmed Somalis, to actually say that we want to take control of our country. One of the things that I think in all of this debate about what's happening in Somalia and the Horn of Africa, and that conversation is missing, that under the Islamic Court Union, Somalis actually felt on a local level quite secure and peaceful. On a regional level, on an international level, on a national level, the government was in shambles. But on a local level, where people actually live and work and feed their children, they felt at peace. And since then, as Somalia's been trying to actually to resolve its national, international role, its regional role, even in the Horn of Africa, Somalis have suffered. And so what they see is that, you know, the presence of foreign troops is actually just an exacerbation of their problems. If you recall, before 2006, before the invasion of Somalia by Ethiopia, Somalis weren't living in a wonderland, but they had the first peace in almost 19 years. Since the invasion, since the role of international community and international troops in Somalia, they've had the worst fighting in years. They've had wonderfully, horribly bouts of violence, of people being kicked out of their homes. They've had, you know, rising food crisis, and they just cannot survive. And so they see that any aggression is a negative thing.
So on top of that, then, here now you have the United Nations Security Council clearing the way for the establishment of a United Nations peacekeeping force in Somalia. How successful is that likely to be, given what you've described? And is it an issue of whether or not the peacekeeping force is from the United Nations or from the African Union, or do they just not want a peacekeeping force, period?
Well, as Trans-Africa Forum, we support the UN's movements to have a peacekeeping force. We are unilaterally in agreement that it should be an African peacekeeping force. But what needs to happen is a shift from military solutions to a human security solution, one that takes into account Somalis and what they need on a local level as they begin nation building and peace building on a national, international level. It needs to be both processes hand in hand. And I think right now, what the UN has offered, what the AU has offered to some extent, and what the US has offered has only been a top-down approach, which doesn't work for Somalis.
Final question on Somalia is this. You talked about what's at the heart of the violence, and it sounds as if it is a combination of economic and political chaos. Is that a good description?
Most definitely. I mean, if you look at Al-Shabaab, which is not, as the former Undersecretary of African Affairs in the U.S. said, you know, linked to al-Qaeda, al-Shabaab is actually a decentralized group of people who want peace in Somalia and think that the only way to have peace is by, you know, ousting foreigners. And they're united with religion and with an international framework, but they're really trying to secure things on a local level. And I think that that's very indicative of where Somalia is.
You know, every week in Africa Update, we talk about things coming out of Africa, and oftentimes the conversation is like what we've just had with Somalia, and it's very troubling would be the word that I would use. Here's something that perhaps we can put in a very more positive category. Huge crowds turned out in Nigeria last week to greet one of Africa's greatest novelists, Chinua Achebe. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Here he is.
I have come to say thank you. You are my brothers and sisters. I've been away too long. I do miss Nigeria, and that's very strange because when I'm there, we're constantly quarreling.
This was his second time home in 20 years, Roxanne. He's been living in America since a terrible car accident in 1990 that left him in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down. His most famous novel, Things Fall Apart, published more than 50 years ago. How have the views of him locally changed over the years?
Well, I think for people on the ground in Nigeria, they see, especially for the Igbo population, see Achebe as not just a wonderful novelist, but as a curator of their history. He is one of the last generation of people to actually learn about Nigeria and about Africa before colonization, and he writes about those periods quite beautifully, and he's been able to educate the entire world about that existence, those people, and what Nigeria was before it was Nigeria. And I think for that reason, he's dearly loved.
Would you say that he's influenced the worldviews of Nigeria and Africa in a major way?
Most definitely. I don't think you can think of a person who knows anything about Nigeria who hasn't read Achebe. I mean, it's really from his really well-known novels to the things that are lesser known, his commentaries on Nigerian politics, on global politics. All of that has shaped a whole, really now, three generations of Africanists, of Pan-Africanists, of scholars, of human nature, as well as people who are, you know, literary hounds. And so I think that he is a giant among men.
That gives us a nice story to end on for this week's Africa Update. Roxanne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum. She was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now to the East and the story of two brothers who've turned their dreams into a reality. Milton and Fred Ochieng grew up in a small village in western Kenya. They longed to become doctors, so friends and family pooled their money and sent them to America. Unfortunately, while they were in school, the brothers lost both parents to AIDS. Now Milton and Fred are tasked with returning home to finish building the health clinic their father started before getting sick. They join me now. Milton, Fred, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Milton, let me start with you. Talk about how you became interested in medicine.
Well, thank you, Tony. My interest in medicine really, kind of goes back all the way to my teenage years. We were able to see firsthand growing up the difficulties in people accessing healthcare. The nearest hospital was over 20 miles away from our village, and it would take an hour or two to get the patient to the hospital. So sometimes we had patients die when they were being taken to hospital.
Now, both of you attended Dartmouth College. Milton, you've gone on to earn your medical degree, and Fred, you are still working on yours. What was it like trying to gain an education in the United States, Fred?
Milton and I went to a really good high school back in Kenya, and it's while in high school that, we got to realize that there are opportunities to go study abroad. Alliance High School had these two exchange programs, one with Brooks High School in Andover, Massachusetts, and the other one with a high school in England. So Milton actually got to participate in the exchange program with Brooks High School. So he got to travel to the U.S. and see what it was like to go to school in the U.S.
Let me interrupt to bring Milton back in. Talk about, though, even though you've had these other educational experiences, in terms of pursuing your medical degree, it was in the United States where you really, where, as we say here, sometimes the rubber meets the road. How grueling and or difficult was that for you?
Going through Dartmouth was grueling enough, and when I was an undergraduate, I thought it was tough. But I really enjoyed my time at Dartmouth, and it prepared me well for what was to come, which was medical school at Vanderbilt. And then, the rigors of medical school. First, getting to Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee, a totally different environment for me. I was there by myself, and so there was also an element of culture shock, a different part of the country, coming from having been in the north for 4 years and then now down south for another 4 years. And, going into anatomy lab and dissecting cadavers and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to faint on my first day. And all those, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. lectures, and just really, being around people who are so smart and feeling challenged every second of the way, and working so hard, very little sleep. I mean, medical school was rough. I cannot understate that. Vanderbilt provided that special place for me to really, hone in on that interest to give back to my community.
Let's talk about how you're going to do that. Let's talk about how you're going to do that with this plan to do a first hospital in your village.
I think it was in April of 2007, we finally got to open the clinic. And since then, we've seen over 30,000 patients, 85% of whom have been seen for free. Malaria is the disease that's most expensive for us to treat. We see patients with HIV, AIDS, TB. We provide a lot of sort of public health interventions, vaccinations, immunizations for kids. And now the Kenyan government is partnering with us to help us reach out to the communities. We are hoping to break ground on a maternity wing and HIV wing so that we can provide more comprehensive care to the community.
Let's talk for a moment about HIV/AIDS, because as you know, certainly more than half of the world's reported HIV/AIDS cases are in Africa, and We know that you lost both of your parents to that disease. Fred, how do you plan to fight the spread of that disease?
It's going to take efforts and interventions on different levels to, you know, stop the spread. Particularly in our clinic, we've been able to use our interest in soccer and following the example of other nonprofit organizations like Grassroots Soccer that uses the model of, you know, the soccer players who are seen as heroes back in places like Africa. They go out to communities, they model positive behavior in, you know, the youth. So we've been able to put together soccer tournaments in the village and just bring people together to talk about ways to raise HIV awareness, answer the questions that the young people do have about HIV. And really, it does bring together the whole community.
The former president of the United States, George Bush, was very active in promoting an awareness of and an attempt to fight AIDS on the African continent. Are you hopeful that the new president, Barack Obama, who was also from Kenya, is someone who will continue or perhaps even expand those efforts?
We are grateful for President Bush's efforts. Now, we are very excited and extremely proud of President Obama. And as a Kenyan, for me, and as a Luo, because his father is from my tribe, we're really excited for what, you know, the potential of what he's going to do to Africa and to support efforts towards eradicating HIV and supporting people with AIDS. You know, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's been a feminization of HIV/AIDS and, you know, poverty, things like that. So you really need to, you know, support agriculture, support sanitation. You got to support delivery of healthcare so that all of these, you know, a more educated woman is going to have the ability to support herself. And then by turn, she's going to be able to educate her children, the girls, have them go to school. That way together, you know, we can really fight this disease. So we are very hopeful that President Obama is going to continue supporting the work that's going on in Africa.
General, I want to thank both of you. Our time is up, unfortunately. Thank you both, Fred and Milton.
Thank you, Tony.
That was Dr. Milton Ochieng and his brother Fred, who is currently finishing medical school. Their efforts to build a health clinic in their Kenyan village is the subject of a documentary called Sons of Luala. Proceeds from this film will help raise funds for their clinic. Milton joined us from member station KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri, and Fred was at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. The Showtime documentary Very Young Girls provides a chilling look into the world of underage prostitution. The film is based on video shot by two pimps who believe their footage would make them famous. In it, the men are seen coercing and bullying girls as young as 13 into prostitution. The documentary also follows one woman's effort to rescue those girls from the streets.
I guess for me then the bigger question is like, why are you here? Like, why are you not out there tonight? And what makes you kind of stay, or at least try to stay, despite the temptations?
So this is the only place I know. If I don't know this, I know the streets. That's it. And I'm not trying to go back to the streets. It's like, for me to still be here and not even go back to the street, it's like, I thank God. Mm-hmm. Like, I pray every day, like, please help me stop doing it. I don't want to do it no more.
Joining me now is Rachel Lloyd. She is the founder of the outreach organization Girls Educational and Mentoring Services, or GEMS, and Shaquana, one of the young women featured in the documentary. Rachel and Shaquana, welcome to News and Notes. It's nice to have you both on with us.
Thank you for having us.
Let's talk about the documentary first. The very beginning of it, that home footage, I guess, for lack of a better word, the way it begins, was that your intention? How did this project come about?
The project started because we were approached by a film production company, Swinging Tea, who was originally doing the True Life series for MTV, And, you know, they'd done stuff on child soldiers in Iraq and children caught up in the drug trade in Colombia, and had learned about the issue of trafficking and wanted to bring it kind of back home and talk about what was happening, trafficking in New York with the domestic children. And so came to us. We did a little bit of shooting with some of the girls. The pimp footage that you're talking about actually fell into our laps through an undisclosed source, probably halfway through filming. And I felt reluctant to show that initially, but I think it was really helpful ultimately for people to see the reality of pimping and how harsh it really is.
I mean, it is hardcore to watch and to see these young girls and their faces and their stories. Shaquana, you were one of those young girls, correct?
Yes, I was.
One of the things that came through to me in watching it, it seemed as if the girls who turned to this life in the streets did so in part because there were troubles at home and there was no love and life for them at their homes. Is that true for you?
I can say somewhat of that.
Tell us then why you went into the life.
Well, I was 14 years old when I first got approached by a pimp. And it was more so because I thought that he was into me, that he wanted to be my boyfriend. And it just seemed like I could have a better life, a more loving, happy life with a man.
Now, Rachel, when these young girls get caught up like this, is it a situation where once they get in, they don't know how to get out, or is it because they're not sure that they want to get out?
I think wanting to get out could be kind of broken down a little bit more. I mean, I think when girls are being approached at 13, 14, 15, and recognizing the average age in this country for entry is anywhere between 12 and 14 years old, I mean, we're talking about really, really young girls who are really easily manipulated. Many of the girls that we serve come from prior abuse. And so what they're experiencing with this adult predator whose sole goal and mission in life is to recruit them, brainwash them, and make them as loyal as possible in order to make as much money as possible, what they experience with him may feel better than what they were experiencing at home. So, you know, whether it's not necessarily that girls want to stay in the life, but the trauma bond or the Stockholm syndrome that's so strong with their pimp, with their trafficker, is really, really hard to break.
There's a scene in the documentary where a mother goes to the police station for help in finding mm-hmm. her daughter, and she tells the mm-hmm. officer that her daughter is locked in a room with a pimp. But she is just summarily dismissed.
My daughter's in this apartment. This is a pimp. Mm-hmm. And he has a bunch of underage girls in this apartment. This girl told me, anonymous caller, this sort of flyer. She just called tonight. This girl said they're armed and dangerous. They have guns. There's three of them.
They were in the apartment?
She said this is where he's keeping the girls at. That he got them in there. He locks them in the apartment. He beats them.
What do you want me to do for you?
Does law enforcement see prostitutes as perpetrators as opposed to victims?
We definitely are beginning to see a shift, you know, across the country and locally, with some law enforcement who recognize that these aren't child prostitutes or teen prostitutes, but they're victims of trafficking, they're victims of commercial sexual exploitation, and they treat them like victims. That's not necessarily representative of the larger law enforcement culture, and we have a long way to go to help change people's minds about this issue and who these girls really are.
Now, Shaquana, how old are you now?
I'm 19.
Now, you've already talked about how you got into the life. How long were you in it, and how did you get out?
I want to say up until I was like 15 and a half, probably. How I got out of it basically was, like as you see in the movie, I'm in the hospital, and that was when I decided that I just had enough and I didn't want to do that anymore. I was really scared, and I had learned a really hard lesson.
You were clearly abused physically by your pimp, and the scene of you in the hospital would look like a broken nose and missing teeth and bandaged. How low a point was that?
That was a horrible situation, but what I always tell other girls is that even though, like, that was, you know, it was a horrible thing that happened to me, I was really thankful to be alive, and I just had a total new outlook on life. I was really happy to be alive because, you know, there are many girls that, you know, they're not alive because something like that happened to them.
Do you think that you are safe and free from ever going back into that life again?
Most definitely. You know, that was something that I struggled with when I was younger, when I was first going through it, where, you know, I wanted to be home, but then I just kept running back to the streets and I didn't understand it. And it's just like, you know, I realize now that I have a greater purpose on this life. I'm in college, and it's just like I have so much going for me. You know, why put myself back in a situation where it's only going to be a dead end?
You know, Gems, Rachel has played a major role in helping these young girls, and you've been doing it for at least 10 years now, as I understand it. Are you making progress?
I mean, just sitting opposite from Shaquana, and, you know, I mean, obviously we were just talking about college and the way in, and just, you know, kind of remembering that she is in college and, you know, she's a student, you know, eating ramen noodles and carrying her backpack, you know, that, and just remembering kind of where she's come from. Obviously, I mean, just when I look at individual girls' lives, you know, we see real progress.
Shaquana, here's my final question for you. I would imagine that you can identify a young girl who was where you were just by looking at her. And if you see these girls, do you say anything to them? Do you just stand back and watch them? What do you do?
I mean, I could never stand back and, you know, and watch someone hurt. Currently at GEMS, I'm an outreach worker, and what I do is I go into juvenile detention centers or other places, and I speak to young women, you know, about that issue, because it happened to me, and I would never want that to happen to someone. And there have been times where it's just like, you know, I see people that, you know, they reminded me of me when I was 14, and it's sad, because the one thing that I, you know, that I love them, but it's just like the one thing that I don't want to happen to them is not that they wake up in a hospital somewhere, because, you know, I don't want that to happen, but that they wind up dead, because that's the reality of it.
Let me just say, the documentary is hard to watch and hard not to watch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Thank you both very much. Good luck.
Thank you for having
us. You're
welcome. Thank you.
That was Rachel Lloyd, founder of the outreach organization Girls Educational and Mentoring Services, or GEMS, and Shaquana. She is one of the girls featured in the documentary Very Young Girls. They both joined us from the NPR studios in New York. An upcoming film starring Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr. follows the story of a street musician who was also a schizophrenic savant. The Soloist tells the true story of Nathaniel Anthony Ayers. For years, he lived in Los Angeles' homeless wasteland known as Skid Row. There, among the junkies and prostitutes, he played Beethoven on his beat-up violin. Since then, he has played in some of the most hallowed halls of music. And now, Ayers' family has started a new foundation in his name to support programs for people with a mental illness who are artistically gifted. Joining me is Tony Moore, the CEO of the Nathaniel Anthony Ayers Foundation and the brother-in-law of Nathaniel Anthony Ayers. Welcome to News and Notes, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Tell me a little bit more about your brother-in-law. What is his mental disability and how long has he had it?
Nathaniel has been diagnosed as schizophrenic. It actually happened in the 70s when he was attending Juilliard. After that, he actually dropped out of Juilliard. He lived on the streets in Cleveland for a while and then moved to L.A. So for more than 30 years, he actually lived on the streets.
How did he get his formal musical training? You mentioned Juilliard, but had he been trained prior to going to Juilliard?
He had. He was trained. He's from Cleveland, Ohio. He actually went to the Cleveland Music Settlement in Cleveland, Ohio, and then attended Ohio University for a while. He is a classically trained bass musician. Upright bass is what he was actually trained on, and that's what he played while at Juilliard.
Now, when he came to Los Angeles, I'm assuming he came here as a homeless person?
He did. He moved to Los Angeles as a homeless person living on the streets down in Skid Row, and which is where he was discovered playing a violin. As I said, he was classically trained on the bass, but living on the streets, it was difficult for him to get around with the big bass. And so, therefore, he self-taught the cello and the violin.
Now, it was the violin and not the cello that he was playing when he encountered Steve Lopez, the columnist from the LA Times?
That's correct. He had a torn up, tattered violin with two strings remaining on it, and he was playing those two strings when Steve Lopez, looking for a story, stumbled across him and knew immediately he didn't have his violin case open. He wasn't begging for money. But as he listened, he could tell that there was more to the story and he had some serious training.
Now, we have a clip from the movie trailer. Robert Downey Jr. plays the role of the newspaper reporter, Steve Lopez. And, of course, Jamie Foxx plays the role of Nathaniel, who was discovered playing downtown. Here's that clip.
Hi, this is Steve Lopez from the LA Times. I'm calling to see if Nathaniel Ayers attended your school.
He was the most gifted kid I've ever met.
I'm going to write a column about Nathaniel.
People heard that you were just playing with two strings. Some of them thought you might want something better to work with.
I can't cover that.
It's a gift.
What does he have? Schizophrenia?
Oh, you flying that plane?
No, I'm right here.
So that's from the movie. Where is Nathaniel now?
Nathaniel is still living currently in an apartment in Los Angeles.
And how did he get from the streets to an apartment?
With a lot of help, a lot of prodding, a lot of support, Steve Lopez worked tirelessly to try and convince Nathaniel to move off the streets. What happened was when Steve discovered Nathaniel, he wrote a series of articles about Nathaniel and his journey from Juilliard to Skid Row. The community responded very positively to that, to those articles, and started sending gifts, instruments, violins, cellos, other musical instruments to Steve, and Steve would then take them to Nathaniel. He was concerned that Nathaniel was now carrying around multiple musical instruments on the streets, and the streets of Los Angeles, especially Skid Row, can be very dangerous. And so Steve started working with LAMP communities to try and convince Nathaniel that it was too dangerous on the streets and he needed to move indoors. LAMP communities end up building a studio for Nathaniel where Nathaniel would go and play. And after probably a year or so of convincing and probing by Steve Lopez, Nathaniel finally moved into an apartment.
Now, was he getting treatment?
He is not getting medical treatment. He does not take medication. He says it stops him from hearing the music is what he says. But realistically, when Nathaniel went through his bout with schizophrenia in the 70s, the medication was a lot stronger, had a lot more side effects. He's done shock therapy, and he is very resistant to taking medication.
So talk about your foundation that you've begun in his name. What is it? What is your aim exactly?
Well, Nathaniel's sister, Jennifer Ayers Moore, is my sister-in-law. And she grew up seeing Nathaniel as he transformed from the brother that she knew and loved to the stranger with schizophrenia. She also witnessed her mother trying frantically to find help for Nathaniel. And so her vision was to start a foundation that would provide support to people that suffer from mental illnesses as well as their caregivers. The mission of the Nathaniel Anthony Ayers Foundation is we support art programs at mental health and arts organizations that serve the mentally ill. And we place a special emphasis on the artistically gifted.
Now, Nathaniel must see these movie posters that are all over town, all over the country, I imagine, for the film The Soloist, with his image, or with the image, I should say, of Jamie Foxx playing him. What's it been like for Nathaniel to see his unlikely story immortalized in a major Hollywood film?
Well, Nathaniel doesn't pay a lot of attention to that. He's actually seen the movie. He went to a screening of the film itself, and he's not into the capitalistic society, all of the attention he doesn't really care for. His world is music. I mean, to this day, he'll play. Last time we were there in L.A., we actually had the official launch of the foundation on January 28th at the California Endowment in Los Angeles, at which time we had entertainment by Robert Gupta, who's the youngest violinist with the L.A. Philharmonic Orchestra, and Nathaniel played as well. He played his cello. So he attended the launch. And he saw all of the people that were there, but his world is music, and that's where he's at peace. He closes his eyes, he throws his head back, and he just gets lost in his music.
Well, Tony, congratulations. Thank you. Good luck with the foundation.
Thank you, Tony. We appreciate the time.
That was Tony Moore, the CEO of the Nathaniel Anthony Ayers Foundation. He joined me from the Doppler Studios in Atlanta, Georgia.